compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, good morning. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. I am so grateful that I get to spend time with you each morning, and it's all the better when you give me a call at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. So much to talk about. Why don't we first talk a little bit about that terrible tornado that hit six different states, so Kentucky, Tennessee, Arkansas. It just ripped through over the weekend. As of this morning, it looks as though they've counted and confirmed maybe as many as 88 people who have died in these tornadoes. One of which, did you see this, Cyrus? One of these tornadoes went continuously for like over 200 miles. I don't even know how that's possible.
I don't either.
Obliterating everything in its path. One of the biggest stories has to do with people who were in a little town that doesn't exist anymore. It's called Mayfield. Mayfield has been wiped from the map, and it is Mayfield, Kentucky, that is. And it's just amazing what these people went through, and I don't mean amazing in a good way. For example, eight people that they know of, there may be more, they died in the Mayfield Consumer Products Candle Factory. And the news story here from NBC says that its destruction has become a symbol of the tornado's ruinous power. As a catastrophic tornado approached the city Friday, employees of a candle factory, which would later be destroyed, heard the warning sirens and wanted to leave the building. But at least five workers said their supervisors warned employees that they would be fired if they left their shifts early. But there's a tornado outside, and it's coming in our... Yeah, you'll be fired if you leave. But there is a tornado.
We're not going to let that affect our bottom line. Get back to work.
Yeah, because you'll get fired if you survive... You know, if you survive the tornado, you won't get fired. So they had basically a couple choices, leave and get fired. In a way, I'm kind of, I don't know if I should say I'm glad that this company has been obliterated. I mean, maybe there are people out there who are glad of that. It's a terrible tragedy either way, but these poor workers, they were told, if you leave, you get fired. So if they stay, they don't get fired, but they either die or they barely make it through. I don't like those odds one way or the other. For hours, as word of the coming storm spread, as many as 15 workers beseeched their managers to let them take shelter in their own homes, only to have the requests rebuffed. Fearing for their safety, some left during their shifts regardless of the repercussions. At least eight people died in the Mayfield Consumer Products Factory.
They knew it was coming for hours?
Well, they had the warnings because you're right, yeah. It had touched down. So it was, and they knew where this tornado was and where it was headed. It was headed toward them.
I wonder if there'll be any manslaughter charges brought against
that this is a very interesting team. Question.
Interesting.
I wonder if any of the managers who were in charge of telling the employees that they would get fired. Well, we'll see what happens. So here's the rest of the story. So at least eight people died in that factory. They make scented candles. They made scented candles. The facility was leveled. All that's left is rubble. Photos and videos of the widespread mangled remains have become symbols of the enormous destructive power of the tornado system. The governor of Kentucky, Andy Beshear, said Monday that 74 people were confirmed dead in the state. That number has gone up since yesterday. Michaela Emery, 21, said in an interview from her hospital bed that workers first asked to leave shortly after tornado sirens sounded outside the factory about 5:30 in the evening. Employees congregated in bathrooms and inside hallways, but the real tornado didn't arrive for several more hours. After employees decided that the immediate danger had passed, several began asking to go home. The workers said people had questions. They wanted to know if they could go home. Can I leave? Some preferred to stay at work and make extra money. Overtime pay was available, but it wasn't clear whether those who stayed were offered additional pay. Supervisors and team leaders told employees that leaving would probably jeopardize their jobs. If you leave, you're more than likely to be fired. Emery said she overheard managers telling four workers standing near her these four workers wanted to leave. She said, I heard it with my own ears. About 15 people asked to go home during the night shift shortly after the first emergency alarm sounded outside the facility. There was a 3 to 4 hour window between the first and second emergency alarms when workers should have been allowed to go home. Initially, one of the employees said team leaders told her they would not let workers leave because of safety precautions, so they kept everyone in the hallways and bathrooms. Once they mistakenly thought the tornado was no longer a danger, they sent everyone back to work. Anyone who wanted to leave should have been allowed to, she said. Elijah Johnson, 20 years old, was working in the back of the building when several employees wanted to head home and walked in to speak to supervisors. He joined in on the request. I asked to leave, and they told me I'll be fired if I do. Even with the weather like this, you're still going to fire me, he said. Yes, said a manager. Johnson said managers went so far as to take a roll call in hopes of finding out who had left work. Company officials deny the allegations. It's absolutely untrue, said Bob Ferguson, a spokesman for Mayfield Consumer Products. We've had a policy in place since COVID began. Employees can leave anytime they want to leave, and they can come back the next day. Does that sound real to you, Cyrus, that a company would have a policy? You know what? Go home anytime you want to. Just go home if you want to, and you can come back the next day. No problem. No questions asked. Does that sound real to you? Doesn't sound real
to
me.
It does not, no.
He also denied that managers told employees that leaving their shifts meant risking their jobs. Blah, 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 blah. 8 people in that company were killed.
Oh.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, terrible. Now, to give you an idea of just the insanity of these tornadoes, this is an article from the AP. A photo from one of the homes that was damaged in one of the tornadoes was found 130 miles away. Talk about wind. Katie Poston, she walked outside Saturday morning to her car, parked in her driveway. She saw something that looked like a note or a receipt stuck to her windshield. She looked at it. It was a black and white photo of a woman in a striped sundress and a headscarf holding a little boy in her lap. On the back, written in cursive, it said, Gertie Swatzel and J.D. Swatzel, 1942. A few hours later, she would discover that the photo had made quite a journey, 130 miles on the back of these tornadoes. Poston had been tracking the tornadoes that hit on Friday, killing, as we know now, over 80 people. They came close to where she lives in New Albany, Indiana, across the Ohio River from Louisville. So she figured that the debris must have come from someone's damaged home in that area. Seeing the date, I realized that was likely from a home hit by a tornado. How else is it going to get here? She said in an interview. It's not a receipt. It's a well-kept photo. So doing what any 21st century person would do, she posted an image of the photo on Facebook and Twitter and asked for help in finding its owners. She said she was hoping someone on social media would have a connection to the photo or share it with someone who had a connection. And that's what happened. A lot of people shared it on Facebook. Someone came across it who was friends with a man by that last name, and they tagged him. The man was Cole Swatzel, who commented that the photo belonged to family members in Dawson Springs, Kentucky, 130 miles away as the crow flies, 167 miles away by car. Swatzel didn't respond to a Facebook message seeking comment. In Dawson Springs, a town of about 2,700 people, 60 miles east of Paducah, this is in Kentucky, homes were leveled, trees were splintered, and search and rescue teams continued to scour the community for any survivors. Dozens of people across the 5 states were killed. The fact that the photo traveled 130 miles is, according to John Snow, a meteorology professor at the University of Oklahoma, he says it's unusual, but it's not that unusual. I never would have guessed that that's true. In one documented case from the 1920s, paper debris traveled 230 miles from the Missouri Boot Heel into southern Illinois. The paper debris rides winds sometimes reaching heights of 30 to 40,000 feet above the ground. Unbelievable.
Wow!
130 miles. So, anyway, that may they rest in peace. That's still being sorted out right now. One other thing that is good and bad together, there was another school shooting last week. It kind of came and went, didn't it, Cyrus? The quick news cycle.
Yeah, 24-hour news cycle. Most of us seem to only have an attention span of about 24 hours when it comes to a school shooting.
I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Yeah, real funny.
Yeah.
Uh huh. This is really sad.
Sad. It is sad, but there's also a positive part of it. A young man, 16 years old, his name was Tate Myre, M-Y-R-E. Here's how CNN describes it. Tate Myre was dedicated to his sport. He was a star football player. He had earned a spot on the varsity team since he was a freshman at Oxford High School. Not only was he talented on the field, he excelled academically and was an honor student. The team tweeted Tuesday evening, "It is with great grief that one of the victims of the tragic event at OHS today was one of our own, Tate Meyer. Tate was a great young man with a bright future and beloved by all. You will be missed, Tate." Meyer's own Twitter account is full of game highlights and scrimmage videos showing his abilities. One of his last tweets from November 28th thanked the University of Toledo football team for having him at one of their games. After the school shooting, when Tate Meyer's body had been loaded into the deputy's car, he died on his way to the hospital. He says, "My life has been broken just like that." Ty Meyer, who identified himself as Tate's older brother on Instagram, "Never in my life will I feel this pain again. It still isn't right. It can't be. I miss you with everything in my heart, Tate. What I would do to see you one more time, or listen to your voice one more time, or block for you one more time, wrestle one more time. I had such high hopes for your future, and I couldn't wait to see you make your dream come true, for me to be right by your side along that road." That's his brother. Now, what happened was that when the school shooting took place, this young man, he rushed the shooter. So he's actively saving his friends and classmates, and he was shot multiple times, giving his life in defense of his friends and his classmates. So the school recognizes him as a hero because rather than try to get away or hide, he went toward the shooter and did what he could to try to stop him from shooting other people. And he very well may have prevented other people from dying in this school shooting. That may be why it's terrible enough, but only four people were killed, he being one of them. So as Jesus said, no greater love has any person, any man, than to lay down his life for his friends. Yeah. And that's what this 16-year-old did. May he rest in peace.
You know, one thing I've noticed with this particular school shooting, and maybe it's just what I've seen, it's focus more on there's been focus on the victims and not on the shooter. And I could be wrong, but just my experience.
You mean like not mentioning the shooter's name in public?
That's right. Yeah, people aren't talking about the shooter as much as they're talking about these kids and what they had done so far and the kind of lives they led and the potential that's gone.
I can see, I see your point. I can see why, because of, obviously this is heinous and horrifying, where as a way to deprive the shooter of any, maybe his intention was to become famous or to get his 15 minutes of fame, get his name in the headlines. Remember I told you, maybe 3-4 weeks ago that Nancy and I attended one of the active shooter training sessions for our parish?
Yep. Yeah.
Interesting that you bring this up because the police officers who conducted the training session, it was about, 2.5 hours long, 3 hours long, but they made a point of saying that they never refer to any of these shooters by name if they were showing a video or they were showing a headline or something, photographs. They would always block it out, and their personal policy was we deprive the shooter of any kind of notoriety
Good.
At all.
I like that.
Yeah.
I really like, I still think Columbine and, Eric and Dylan. I only know the shooter's name. I don't know a single, off the top of my head, I can't name one of the victims.
Right.
And that's not good. That's, shame on me. I wish I could push these two kids out of my head forever. And they're just it's happened so many times now.
The one student who was killed, among the many, including teachers who were killed, I don't remember her name, but I remember that the story associated with her death was that that one of these shooters came up to her and says, "Do you believe in God?" And she said, "Yes." And then he shot her. Now, I should remember her name because there was a book that came out about her life called She Said Yes. And it was all about her, just her life in general. But of course, at the very end, she said, "Yes, I believe in God." And that was what prompted them to kill her. I suppose they would have shot her anyway.
Cassie Bernal?
Cassie Bernal. There you go. Did you know that or did you look it up?
I looked it up.
Yeah.
She was specifically blonde. Asked Google, Columbine teacher who said yes.
Okay, there it is. She was blonde, as I recall, right? I remember seeing her picture on the front of the book cover.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to be morose, but I did want to highlight the heroism of that young man, that even though the tragedy unfolded and he died, he was willing, he was proactively trying to save other people by attacking the shooter. Good for him. I don't know what else to say about that, but mm-hmm. I mean, even the pain of his death must be devastating for his family.
Oh, and it looks like I lost Patrick, so I'm going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Relevant Radio runs on horsepower, your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep our stations running. Join in with hundreds of other listeners who have donated their used vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
This time each year. Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
This album is a family favorite here at Rancho Madrid. We play the Beach Boys Christmas album every year for, I don't know.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't know that.
35 years, 40 years maybe.
Very cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Beach Boys were still together when we were playing this. They may still be together. Let's go to Matt in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Good morning, Matt. Thank you for waiting and welcome.
Good morning. I have a question about pre-incarnate Jesus. Now, this during the pandemic, I was listening to a lot of Protestant pastors, and they introduced me to this messianic rabbi, Jewish rabbi. I think from the Jewish rabbis where I heard this term, this pre-incarnate Jesus, and his claim was that every time in the Old Testament you see like angel of the Lord, or, you know, for example, Moses saw God walking from in front of him, Jacob wrestles with God. In the book of Daniel, there's someone else in the fire with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And, you know, other instances of the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament. And he was saying that every time you see that, you know, that's Jesus. And I know we just had some readings in the book of Daniel. I think it was that the fire one, for example. And that made me kind of remember him saying that. And I just wanted to know if Catholics believe that, because obviously Jesus existed from all time before he was born of Mary. So I wanted to get your take on it.
Yeah, for sure. So you're right. Jesus as God has always existed. So, you know, we have to speak in terms of time. That's all we know. But there was no time when Jesus as the second person of the Trinity did not exist. So we're talking here about the incarnation. Now, the term that's used to describe what he's referring to is called a theophany. And there are theophanies in the Old Testament, to be sure. So we see the examples that you gave in Exodus chapter 3 with the burning bush, Moses meeting God in that form, Adam and Eve walking with God in the garden before the fall, and many other examples, the three angels who came and visited Abraham and Sarah. So the way the church looks at that is to say that these can be understood as theophanies, in that God was appearing to human beings, whether individually or as the triune God. Some see in the Genesis example where Abraham and Sarah are visited by these three angels, that those three angels may in fact have been the persons of the Trinity. Now, there's no like set teaching. The church doesn't say that definitely was a theophany, but it's permitted to see in that incident the possibility of a theophany. Melchizedek, another example, when he visits Abraham and he has this sacrifice that he offers in the presence of Abraham, the sacrifice of bread and wine, that too is understood to be very possibly a theophany of Christ. So the minister, whoever he may be, I mean, he's not saying anything new or unique. This is something that the church, going back to the church fathers, has commented on any number of times. But I would just say we should exercise caution here, because it's not true that every single time you see an angel in the Old Testament, that must be God. That's not true. There are instances where angels would be, as God's ministering servants, sent to perform some errand, some mission. And those were not God, those were angels. Sometimes when they're called angels, they may in fact have been God visiting and being called an angel. So I would just offer that by way of a caution, so that we don't say that every single time we see an angel, that must be God. But sometimes, I think so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that helps and that makes sense because I haven't really given it much thought until we had those you know readings from Daniel in the first or second week of Advent, and then it kind of reminded me of it. Mm-hmm. And I guess you know, regardless if it's Jesus or not, I mean, angel of the Lord, it's God, right? I mean, so you can pick hairs kind of all you want is kind of my attitude toward it. But I was still kind of curious if there actually was a teaching that I should you know kind of align with. So I appreciate it. Thanks, Patrick.
You got it. Thank you. Yeah, the significant teaching to focus on, of course, would be the incarnation that, as it says in John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. So in the incarnation, when God, the second person of the Trinity, joined a human nature to his divine nature and became a human being, he wasn't split down the middle. He wasn't like 50% God, 50% human. He was true God and true man, as we profess in the Creed. So that, of course, is a very sublime reality that is still being pondered and wondered about, all the immense truth that's packed into that one word, incarnation. We still haven't fully understood all of it, nor will we until we get to heaven. We'll understand it far better when we get there. But in the meantime, it's very good to ponder that doctrine as fundamental to the faith as a whole. 888-914-9149. Just to switch gears for a minute, Cyrus, any plans to go to Austria anytime soon?
No. I scratched those plans.
Those are gone.
Yeah.
You're not going to Austria.
Not doing it.
I don't know if this would apply to you in any case, but for those, you know, in Austria, the government has announced that it's going to impose a $15,000 a year fine for people who don't get vaccinated. This is from the UK Sun. The move comes amid a shift across much of Europe toward increasingly harsh measures to crack down on vaccine hesitancy amid fears that Omicron patients will overwhelm hospitals under... By the way, Omicron has been with us now for, what has it been, a month, 6 weeks, something like that? And I saw over the weekend that the first death from this variant has been recorded. One person. Under Austria's plans to make injections against the coronavirus compulsory from February onwards, it comes as Europe's coronavirus death toll could soar by another 700,000 this winter, according to the World Health Organization. Austria's conservative-led government today gave details of its plan to make the coronavirus vaccines compulsory, saying it will apply to people 14 and over, and if you don't get it, you'll be faced with a fine of about $4,000 every 3 months. So, yeah, it's actually going to be over 16,000. If you do the math, roughly 68% of Austria's population is vaccinated fully against COVID. But what is fully nowadays? Fully used to be two, right? I'm trying to do the math here. So you have to get the first one, then nearly a month later, you get the second one. Then you were fully vaccinated, but you still have to wear a mask because you can still get it and you can still give it. So your life doesn't really change. But now fully vaccinated is changing, and I guess, does the booster count as being fully vaccinated? If you have two but you don't have the booster, are you considered fully vaccinated? I think in some places you're not. Many Austrians are skeptical about vaccines, a view encouraged by one of the parties in their parliament. As infections set records 3 weeks ago, the government announced a fourth national lockdown and said it would make vaccinations compulsory for all. This is the first European Union country to do this. The Minister for Constitutional Affairs says, "We do not want to punish people who are not vaccinated. We want to win them over and convince them to get vaccinated. But we're going to punish them by fining them $4,000, 3,600 euros.
Do you think that guy that got 10 COVID vaccine shots in one single day, would they consider him vaccinated?
I'll bet you that he would be sort of like the poster boy for being fully vaccinated. He got all 10 shots in one day, in one sitting. Can you imagine how sore his arm is?
More sore than the guy who used a fake arm.
Totally more sore. The guy with the fake arm, the silicone arm, he didn't feel any pain.
Oh, bizarre world.
Isn't it interesting that, so Austria is going to fine people $4,000 per quarter for not getting vaccinated. And Australia, two obviously very different countries, but they are sort of taking the lead when it comes to persecuting people in the same way. One more quick story, and I want to get back to the phone calls. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We have some lines open. An Arkansas waitress. When I read this story the first time, I was at first not quite sure what to make of it, but as I read it and reread it, I became more irritated with the employer here. Tell me what you think. An Arkansas waitress received a $4,400 tip, only to be fired after her manager made her split it with other staffers. This tip came on December the 6th. The waitress's name is Ryan Brandt. This is a lady. And there was she and another server worked a party of more than 40 at Oven and Tap in Bentonville. Now, this is Arkansas. The name of the place is Oven and Tap in Bentonville, Arkansas. Each diner of the group of at least 40 people chipped in $100 in tip money, believing that the tip... Yeah?
No, I didn't know my mic was
You're clearing your throat. I thought maybe you were...
A rookie mistake. Rookie mistake.
Oh, man. All right, Cyrus. So the $100 in tip money per person, they got this pot of about $4,400 for the tip for the two servers. One of the people in the group, Grant Wise, he was part of this group. He said to the news, "We knew the servers were really hit hard through COVID, and it was something that we had come up with to help them to help give back. But the restaurant's manager instructed Brandt, who is the waitress, to pool the tip with her coworkers who did not serve the large party."
Here, you want to hear her words? This is exactly what she had to say. It's really, really short.
"I was to give my cash over to my shift manager to be taken, and then that I was going to be taking home 20%.
Yeah, you don't get $4,400. I'm sorry. You get 20% of that. So what's that, $880? It's not quite the same, is it?
Still a pretty good night on getting tips.
But which would you rather have, $4,400? She would get half of it in any case.
I have conflicted feelings about this whole story.
I do too.
I want to hear what you have to say here.
Okay, so because I know that you were a waiter for a while. She said she would get the 20%. So when Wise, who owns a real estate company called Whitley, W-I-T-L-Y, when he found it, because he was part of this group that got the money together to give to the waitresses, when he found out, he demanded that the restaurant return the tip money, and then he turned the $2,200 over directly to the waitress, Brandt. She got fired the next day. She said, "They fired me from Oven and Tap over the phone. I've been there for 3.5 years, and that was really heartbreaking, especially because I didn't think I did anything wrong." In a statement, Oven and Tap said that Brandt, this is the waitress, was fired for reasons unrelated to the tipping incident, and that it had fully honored the generous tipper's request to reward the pair of servers at their party. After dining, this large group of guests requested that their gratuity be given to two particular servers. "We fully honored their request," read the statement that was provided to local news outlets. "Out of respect for our highly valued team members, we do not discuss the details surrounding the termination of an employee. The server who was terminated several days after the group dined with us." No, it was not several days. It was the next day. The very next day she got fired. After the group dined with us, she was not let go because she chose to keep the tip money. By the way, it was her money. She didn't have to choose to keep it. It was given to her. The other two servers who received generous tips that evening from the Whitley organization, including one who also received $2,200, are still members of our team. So what did Mr. Weiss do? He, again, was the leader of that group. He started a GoFundMe page for Brandt, and as of, I guess it was Friday of last week, it had raised nearly $9,000. I'd like to check that and see how much it is now. And she said, "It was devastating. I borrowed a lot of money for student loans. Most of them were turned off because of the pandemic, but they're turning back on in January." And she's without a job now. So tell me about your mixed emotions, Cyrus. I'm totally on her side. I think what they did to her, based upon everything I read, I think it was wrong. I think they were greedy. Hey, I want some of that for me.
Yeah.
That's how it came across to me.
All right. So when you get a tip that big, it's only proper and right to share it with your coworkers. You got to share with the cooks, the busboys, the host staff, pretty much everyone but management. And that's the right thing to do. Now, I'm not saying you share it evenly across the board, but if you're getting a $2,200 tip,
it's good to give back to some of the people who helped.
Give back to some of the other people. So she should have if she's only getting 20% of that, that's not right. That's wrong in and of itself. Yeah. But if she wanted to grease everybody $100 or whatever, that would have been a very nice gesture.
I agree with that.
And the reason she didn't do that and she wanted the money for herself is because she has student loans. So I have this is the reason she wanted the money.
It was devastating. I borrowed a significant amount of money for student loans. Most of them, you know, were kind of turned off for the COVID year and a half. And they are turning back on January 1st. And that's like a reality I'm facing.
Yeah. You know what? Yeah. Everybody has bills. Every last person she's working with has bills.
Yes.
Yeah. So there, I think there's a, when it's, I've seen server, I've been given a large sum of money and you share it. It's the right thing to do with people that are helping the guests have a wonderful evening eating out.
I agree with that. But here's my question. As a waiter, if you were given that tip, okay, you have the right to be cool and do the right thing. And as you said, grease other people, let them wet their beaks too. You have the right to do that. But don't you also have the right to not be cool and not do the right thing and just say, well, I'm going to be this way and just hang on to that money?
Yep. And then she has the right to go find employment elsewhere.
But is that a fireable offense, though? I don't
probably
think so.
Not. But we really don't know the reason she was fired. This might have just been one more notch in someone that's constantly complaining about sharing her I'm told this is all speculation. Yeah. I have no idea. This could be the most wonderful lady in the whole world. She maybe did grease everybody, and she's just not talking about that part of the story.
Maybe so.
So we just don't have enough information. But from my own personal experience, waiting tables, if you get big tips, you share them. It's the right thing to do. And you sleep better at night. At the end of the day, money is only so important.
That's true.
Making the people around you comfortable and happy, and sharing the wealth. You have to share the wealth. You should. Well, you don't have to. You should.
Your reaction is maybe. See, you landed on a different part of this than I did, because I was landing on the fact that she got canned. Seemingly, again, like you're right, yeah. Because it may well be that there's more to the story that is not in the press, and she may be a difficult person. There could be any number of things. Yeah. But it comes across as though they didn't like the fact that she wound up with the money that they wanted her to share, and so they retaliated against her.
Yeah, I know what it's like when you get that money and the little green-eyed monster inside of us wants to take over and is like, this is mine. So I know that feeling, and I know how hard it is to combat it. Yeah. But you do. And so I don't know. This could be the nicest lady in the whole world. I have no idea. It's all speculation. So. And I hope she lands on her feet. It sounds like she's doing well. I'm trying to find out how much this GoFundMe. You found it?
I found it. Yeah. Oh. It, as of right now, $8,732.
Okay.
So not that much.
No. You know? No. So for waiting tables, probably, you know.
What would that be? That's 6 months? No, probably less than that. Probably about 3 months worth of salary and tips.
Probably, yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we'll see what happens. I don't know that we'll come back to that story ever.
Probably not. No.
I don't know if it's that important, but I thought it was interesting. And it is good to look at it from a couple different angles. We have to take a break. We're going to take some more phone calls. The number again, 888-914-9149. And Cyrus, can you get that Eric Clapton song called Tears in Heaven? Can you get that ready?
Yep, I got it right here.
Okay, I want to talk about that. There's a backstory to that song, Tears in Heaven. Very, very popular song. Love the song, actually. And I knew the backstory, but it has sort of resurfaced again, and I want to share that with you. It is very poignant. Let's put it that way. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question?
give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. Hey! That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
We are back. Let's see. I'm balancing. I'm going to tip in favor of a couple phone calls before we get to the Tears in Heaven story. Let's go to Teresa in Salt Lake City. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, Patrick. I have a quick question for you. I'm looking for a recommendation on a book. We are sponsoring a family. Me and many other people are sponsoring a family that are refugees from Africa.
Okay.
We're sponsoring them for Christmas. And the children range in age from 3 months to 21 years. And the other day, the 21-year-old daughter approached one of the people that are helping and said, we just saw a movie about Santa Claus and wanted to know if that was indeed a fact. I need to be really careful here. And the person who answered them in an adult answer, but didn't really give the mm-hmm. Christian meaning behind Christmas and St. Nicholas. And so they were just kind of given an answer. But I feel like they need to know the real story behind Santa Claus and Christmas. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to start it. I'm hoping maybe you can help me with that.
I'll do my best. First, I'll recommend a book. It's published by Ignatius Press. It's called The True Meaning of Christmas, The Birth of Jesus and the Origins of the Season. So that would be a very good book to draw from. I mean, you could share with them. You could share the book with them if you wanted to, or you could just read the book and then share what you've learned from the book. So in the description of the book, here are a few tidbits. How is the Christmas story related to an ancient Jewish expectations? Why is Jesus said to be laid in a manger? Who are the Magi? What is the mysterious Christmas star? How did December 25th become the date of Christmas? How did St. Nicholas become Santa Claus? So these are all elements, of that book. And my guess is that once you've read it and you've sort of assimilated that information, then you'd be in a good position to share it with them. I would be surprised, though, if they didn't have some. I mean, Africa, it's on the other side of the world, but so is China, and they know all about Christmas there and Santa Claus. They know, I'm sure, the secular version of it. Did you get the impression that they don't celebrate Christmas the way we do in their country?
I wasn't there when the question was answered. I only heard about it second or third hand, but it bothered me. Clearly, she's not making the connection between Santa Claus and Christmas. And I think it's important. That's all I'm trying to do, is trying to make that connection.
Definitely. I think that's good. That's thoughtful of you.
Yep.
And to also explain to them the origin of the custom of Santa Claus. There really was a St. Nicholas. In fact, last week on the program, I talked about the real St. Nicholas and how he was a bishop who attended the first Council of Nicaea in the year 325. He was an opponent, even perhaps to the point of physical violence, it seems. There's a story told. Hard to know whether or not it actually happened, but there is a legend that St. Nicholas actually punched out Arius, the heretic, at this council. He grabbed him by the beard and pulled him down off his chair and smacked him or something along those lines. So whether or not that in fact happened, he was known for giving gifts to people. And it started in particular with three young women who were very poor and very likely to be, let's just put it as having to go into a certain profession to earn money that would have been very immoral. And so he got some money and gave it to them surreptitiously, threw the money into the window of their room at night, and that saved them. So that was a dowry so that these girls could get married. And so the story about giving gifts at night, where St. Nicholas shows up and gives gifts secretly, that all goes back to him. So you could tie that in as well.
Great. Can you tell me the name of the book one more time?
Yes, it is called The Real Meaning of Christmas.
Okay, and St. Ignatius. All right, thank you very much.
You are welcome. Thank you. I hope you have a wonderful, blessed Christmas with this family. How nice of you to be sponsoring them. How about Patrick now in Trenton, New Jersey? Good morning, Patrick.
Yes, hi, Patrick. Happy Taco Tuesday.
Okay, Happy Taco Tuesday. That's right.
I just had a question. I do a prayer group now, and
couple of ladies speaking tongues, and I was wondering where that started, and can you speak in tongues, and how do you know if you're actually doing it? Like,
okay. Yeah, good question. So let's get the last question out of the way. How do you know? There are people who do, in fact, have that charismatic gift. So the charismatic gifts include tongues and prophecy and discernment and at times even healing and other gifts that are sometimes given. In the charismatic renewal, which is really where you would see this, there are people who, I think anyway, and this is just my opinion, who do in fact have this charismatic gift. But I also do believe, after observing closely for many years, that there are people who don't in fact have the gift, but they're mimicking what they hear other people say. So they hear other people saying these syllables and whatnot, so they start doing it in their enthusiasm. I don't fault their, you know, their desire to experience a gift of the Holy Spirit. But I do believe that there are people who really don't have that gift, who may think they do, and they're mimicking what they hear other people say. Now, only God ultimately knows, but based upon observation, that's my impression. Do I speak in tongues? No, never have. I'm not part of the charismatic renewal. I don't feel at all drawn to it. I have no criticism at all of anybody who does, but I don't. So it's never been a prayer form that has attracted me. And where did it start? It started on the day of Pentecost. Most specifically, it started on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, where the apostles, after coming out of the upper room filled with the Holy Spirit, were told that in this version of, there seemed to be two forms of the gift of tongues. This form was that they could speak either in languages that they didn't know, or, as it's described, they spoke in their own language, but their language was accessible in the minds of other people who did not speak Aramaic or Hebrew. So coming from all these different countries and not knowing the language that the apostles spoke, yet they could still understand it in their own tongue. That's what the book of Acts tells us about this phenomenon. The other version of the gift of tongues is where you're speaking in a tongue that you yourself don't necessarily understand. Now, St. Paul gives some very important guidelines on this topic. And he reminds us that, he reminds us that the gift of tongues is, you know, perhaps even the least of the gifts. It's not the greatest of all the gifts. But he also talks about how there should be order in the assembly. So this is in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. So he talks about how prophecy is a better gift than tongues. He says, "For one who speaks in a tongue speaks not to men but to God, for no one understands him, but he utters mysteries in the Spirit. On the other hand, he who prophesies speaks to men for their upbuilding and encouragement and consolation. He who speaks in a tongue edifies himself, but he who prophesies edifies the church." So in this passage, he gives some guidelines, including, he says, when you're all together, you should not all be praying in tongues at the same time. He says that could be scandalous for people who don't understand what's going on. He said also, you should not pray in tongues more than one person at a time, so that, and then only if there's somebody who can interpret the tongue. So I would encourage anybody who has questions about this to read 1 Corinthians chapter 14 from top to bottom. Read the entire chapter, and you'll see there that often in the charismatic renewal, again, in my own experience, so it's purely anecdotal, but in my experience, even though I'm not a member of the charismatic renewal, I have been around it quite a bit and have been, you know, at events that have been conducted by those in the renewal. Excuse me. And I have seen very often things done in a way that's contrary to what St. Paul points out in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. So I give you that for your consideration. I appreciate the call, Patrick. Let's see. Before we go to the phones again, I want to just share the story about Tears in Heaven. Can you play a little bit of the song, Cyrus, so people know what we're talking about? I think most people will know. I think everybody who has heard the radio at all since 1993 when Eric Clapton released this song, knows that song. It's a much beloved song. So when he released the song, he won 3 Grammys that year. That was 1993 for Song of the Year, Record of the Year, and Best Male Pop Vocal Performance. The story behind it, though, involves a tragedy. And it involves a little boy. And I'll share the specifics with you here. It resulted one morning in March of 1991. Lori Del Santo, she at the time, I guess, was the girlfriend of Eric Clapton. And their little son, Connor, had gone to visit Eric Clapton in New York to spend some family time, although the couple had already been separated. She was an Italian model. So they had been dating for a while. She became pregnant. He was still married to Patty Boyd when this took place. And long story short, a little boy named Connor was born after they had separated. So this is a story as it's told here by El País, the Madrid, Spain newspaper. So he went to go visit Clapton in New York. So with this meeting in New York, Clapton, who was little present in the boy's life, had set out to strengthen his father-son relationship. The day before the fatal outcome, Eric and Connor were at Long Island Circus. Lori, the mother, remembers it as one of the happiest days in her son's life. They had a really good time. When Eric came back, he looked at me and said that he finally understood what it meant to have a child and to be a father. He was very happy. It was the first time that Eric had spent a few hours alone with our son. Connor, for his part, was very excited about the wonderful day he had just spent with his father. The next morning, March 20th, Eric had arranged to pick up Lori and Connor from their apartment on 57th Street in Manhattan, where they were staying, to take them to the Central Park Zoo. Connor was playing with the babysitter while I got ready to go to the zoo. It was 11 a.m. I called to him from the bathroom to hurry up, and he told me he'd be there in a minute. The building's janitor was cleaning the apartment windows, and Lori had asked the babysitter not to lose sight of the boy who was playing hide-and-seek and running around. The babysitter, who was playing chase, stopped short when the janitor warned her that he had opened the window. Connor, unaware that the glass had been removed from the window, took the opportunity to gain the upper hand and ran toward the window. I heard a heart-rending scream that wasn't from Connor, it was from the babysitter. I ran into the room screaming hysterically, "Where's Connor? Where's Connor?" Then I saw the open window and understood what had just happened. Connor Clapton was only 4 years old. He fell through the window of a 53rd floor apartment at 11:57. She called on the phone yelling, "He's dead. I didn't know what he was talking about. The window," explains Eric Clapton. There was a 2017 documentary about his life called The Blues Pattern. He said, "I felt like I was coming out of myself. I couldn't understand it. I couldn't take it. I went with him to the nearest hospital to say goodbye to him. I lost my faith." And within a few years, he had written this song about this terrible tragedy. Now, there's much more to the story if you're interested. It's a very sad story, of course. A little boy died. Cyrus will get this posted for you if you're interested. You can find it on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Not much more I can say about this. I'll be right back. There's peace, I'm sure.